thinking she was partly responsible for Sweetie and Jeff's children. In spite of the fact that she had delivered 32 healthy babies to doing just fine mothers since the last broken Fleetwood baby was delivered. So she said nothing, except that Arnett's time would be March of 75. Pat located the Morgan file and went to the limb that, so far, contained one line. Coffee Smith, a.k.a. K.D., as in Kentucky Derby, M., period, Arnett Fleetwood. She wondered again, who was that boy Ruby Morgan married? An army buddy of her brother's, it was said. But from where? His first name, Coffee, was the same as Zacharias before he changed it to run for lieutenant governor. His last name was as generic as you could get. He was killed in Europe, so nobody got to know him well, not even his wife. You could tell from his photograph there wasn't a brush of Private Smith in his son. K.D. was a mirror of Black Horse and Morgan blood. There wasn't much space beneath the K.D. Arnett entry, but she thought they probably would need more. If it lived, the baby they were expecting would certainly be an only child. Arnett's mother had only two children, one of whom had fathered only defectives. In addition, these later Morgans were not as prolific as the earlier ones. They were not like Zachariah Morgan, a.k.a. Big Papa, nay, Coffee, M. period, Mindy Flood, nota bene, Anna Flood's great aunt, who had 9 of 14 children survive. Pat ran her finger over their names. Prior Morgan, Rector Morgan, Shepherd Morgan, Ella Morgan, Loving Morgan, Selene Morgan, Governor Morgan, Queen Morgan, and Scout Morgan. Scooting up the margin in script black ink, one of her earlier notes read, "It took 7 births for them to get around to giving a female child an administrative, authoritative sounding name, and I bet they called her Queenie." Another comment threaded out from Zachariah's name and led by arrows spread to the back of the page. He renamed himself. Coffee was his birth name, a misspelling of Kofi, probably. And since no Louisiana Morgans or any of the Haven people had worked for any whites named Morgan, he must have chosen his last name, as well as his first, from something or someplace he liked. Zacharias, father of John the Baptist, or the Zachariah who had visions? The one who saw scrolls of curses and women in baskets? The one who saw Joshua's filthy clothes changed into rich ones? Who saw the result of disobedience? The punishment for not showing mercy or compassion was a scattering among all nations, and pleasant land made desolate. All of that would fit nicely for Zachariah Morgan. The curse, the women stuffed into a basket with a lid of lead and hidden away in a house, but especially the scattering. The scattering would have frightened him. The breakup of the group or tribe or consortium of families, or, in Coffee's case, the splitting up of a contingent of families who had lived with or near each other since before Bunker Hill. He would not have had trouble imagining the scariness of having everybody he knew thrown apart, thrown into different places in a foreign land, and becoming alien to each other. He would have been frightened of not knowing a jawline that signified one family, a cast of eye or a walk that identified another, of not being able to see yourself reformed in a third or fourth generation grandchild, of not knowing where the generations before him were buried, or how to get in touch with them if you don't know. That would be the Zachariah Coffey would have chosen for himself. That would have appealed to him if he had heard some mighty preacher tell the story of Joshua crowned. He would not name himself after Joshua the king, but after the witness to whom God and angels spoke on a regular basis about things Coffey knew something about. When she asked Stewart where his grandfather got his name, he grunted and said he thought it was Moyne originally, not Morgan, or Lemoyne or something. But some folks called him Black Coffey. We called him Big Papa. Call my daddy Big Daddy, as though that ended it. Insulted-like, because he himself wasn't a papa or a daddy, big or otherwise. Because the Morgan line was crop feeble. One of Zachariah's Big Papa's sons, Rector, had 7 children with his wife, Beck, but only 4 survived. Elder, the twins, Deacon and Stewart, and KD's mother, Ruby. Elder died, leaving his wife, Susanna Smith Morgan, with 6 children, all of whom moved from Haven to northern states. Zachariah would have hated that. Moving would have been scattering to him. And he was right, for sure enough, from then on, the fertility shriveled, even while the bounty multiplied. The more money, the fewer children. The fewer children, the more money to give the fewer children. Assuming you amassed enough of it, which was why the richest ones, Deke and Stewart, were so keen on the issue of KD's marriage, or so Pat supposed. All of them, however, each and every one of the intact 9 families, had the little mark she had chosen to put after their names, 8R, an abbreviation for 8 Rock, a deep, deep level in the coal mines, blue-black people, tall and graceful, whose clear, wide eyes gave no sign of what they really felt about those who weren't 8 Rock like them. Descendants of those who had been in Louisiana Territory when it was French, when it was Spanish, when it was French again, when it was sold to Jefferson, and when it became a state in 1812, who spoke a patois, part Spanish, part French, part English, and all their own. Descendants of those who, after the Civil War, had defied or hidden from whites, doing all they could to force them to stay and work as sharecroppers in Louisiana. Descendants of those whose worthiness was so endemic, it got 3 of their children elected to rule in state legislatures and county offices, who, when thrown out of office without ceremony or proof of wrongdoing, refused to believe what they guessed was the real reason that made it impossible for them to find other mental labor. Almost all of the Negro men chased or invited out of office in Mississippi, in Louisiana, in Georgia, got less influential but still white-collar work following the purges of 1875. One from South Carolina ended his days as a street sweeper. But they alone, Zachariah Morgan and Juvenal Dupre in Louisiana, Drum Black Horse in Mississippi, were reduced to penury and or field labor. 15 years of begging for sweat work in cotton, lumber, or rice after 5 glorious years remaking a country? They must have suspected, yet dared not say, that their misfortune, was due to the one and only feature that distinguished them from their Negro peers. 8 Rock. In 1890, they had been in the country for 120 years. So they took that history, those years, each other, and their uncorruptible worthiness, and walked to the run. Walked from Mississippi and Louisiana to Oklahoma, and got to the place described in advertisements carefully folded into their shoes or creased into the brims of their hats, only to be shooed away. This time, the clarity was clear. For 10 generations, they had believed the division they fought to close was free against slave and rich against poor. Usually, but not always, white against black. Now they saw a new separation, light-skinned against black. Oh, they knew there was a difference in the minds of whites, but it had not struck them before that it was of consequence, serious consequence, to Negroes themselves. Serious enough that their daughters would be shunned as brides, their sons chosen last, that colored men would be embarrassed to be seen socially with their sisters. The sign of racial purity they had taken for granted had become a stain, the scattering that alarmed Zachariah because he believed it would deplete them, was now an even more dangerous level of evil. For if they broke apart and were disvalued by the impure, then, certain as death, those 10 generations would disturb their children's peace throughout eternity. Pat was convinced that when the subsequent generations of 8 Rock males did scatter, just as Zachariah feared, into the army, it could have been over and done with, should have been over and done with. The rejection, which they called the disallowing, was a burn whose scar tissue was numb by 1949, wasn't it? Oh no, those that survived that particular war came right back home, saw what had become of Haven, heard about the missing testicles of other colored soldiers, about medals being torn off by gangs of rednecks and sons of the Confederacy, and recognized the disallowing part too. It would have been like watching a parade banner that said war-weary soldiers not welcome home. So they did it again. And just as the original wayfarers never sought another colored town site after being cold-shouldered at the first, this generation joined no organization, fought no civil battle. They consolidated the 8 Rock blood, and haughty as ever, moved farther west. The new fathers, Deacon Morgan, Steward Morgan, William Cato, Ace Flood, Aaron Poole, Nathan Dupre, Moss Dupre, Arnold Fleetwood, Ossie Beauchamp, Harper Jury, Sergeant Person, John Seawright, Edward Sands, and Pat's father Roger Best, who was the first to violate the blood rule, the one nobody admitted existed, the one established when the Mississippi flock noticed and remembered that the disallowing came from fair-skinned colored men, blue-eyed, gray-eyed yellow men in good suits. They were kind, though, as the story went. Gave them food and blankets, took up a collection for them, but were unmoving in their refusal to let the 8 Rocks stay longer than a night's rest. The story went that Zachariah Morgan and Drum Black Horse forbade the women to eat the food, that Jupe Cato left the blankets in the tent with a collected offering of $3.09 neatly stacked on top. But Soane said her grandmother, Celeste Black Horse, sneaked back in and got the food, but not the money, secretly passing it to her sister, Sally Black Horse, to Biddy Cato, and Praise Compton, to distribute to the children. So the rule was set, and lived a quietly throbbing life, because it was never spoken of, except for the hint in words Zachariah forged for the oven. More than a rule, a conundrum. Beware the furrow of his brow, in which the you understood vocative case was not a command to the believers, but a threat to those who had disallowed them. It must have taken him months to think up those words, just so, to have multiple meanings, to appear stern, urging obedience to God, but slyly not identifying the understood proper noun or specifying what the furrow might cause to happen or to whom. So the teenagers Meisner organized, who wanted to change it to be the furrow of his brow, were more insightful than they knew. Look what they did to Menace, forcing him to give back or return the woman he brought home to marry, the pretty sandy-haired girl from Virginia. Menace lost, or was forced to give up, the house he'd bought for her, and hadn't been sober since. And though they attributed his weekend drunks to his Vietnam memories, and although they laughed with him as he clipped their hair, Pat knew love in its desperate state when she saw it. She believed she had seen it in Menace's eyes, as well as in her father's, poorly veiled by his business ventures. Before she put away the KD pages, Pat scribbled in the margin, "Somebody beat up Arnett. The convent women, as folks say, or quiet as it's kept, KD." Then she picked up the file for Best, Roger. On the back of the title page labeled Roger Best, M period, Delia, she wrote, "Daddy, they don't hate us because Mama was your first customer. They hate us because she looked like a cracker and was bound to have cracker-looking children like me. And although I married Billy Cato, who was an eight-rock like you, like them, I passed the skin on to my daughter, as you and everybody knew I would. Notice how a lot of those Sands who married Seawrights are careful to make sure that their children marry into other eight-rock families? We were the first visible glitch, but there was an invisible one that had nothing to do with skin color. I know all of the couples wanted preacher-attended marriages, and many had them, but there were many others that practiced what Ferry Dupre called takeovers. A young widow might take over a single man's house. A widower might ask a friend or a distant relative if he could take over a young girl who had no prospects. Like Billy's family. His mother, Fawn, born a black horse, was taken over by his grandmother's uncle, August Cato. Or, to put it another way, Billy's mother was wife to her own great-uncle. Or another way, my husband's father, August Cato, is also his grandmother's, Biddy Cato Black Horse's, uncle, and therefore Billy's great-granduncle as well. Biddy Cato's father, Sterl Cato, took over a woman named Honesty Jones. It must have been she who insisted on naming her daughter Friendship, and she was probably riled at hearing the child call Biddy for the rest of her life. Since Biddy Cato married Peter Blackhorse, and since her daughter, Fawn Blackhorse, was wife to Biddy's uncle, and since Peter Blackhorse is Billy Cato's grandfather, well, you can see the problem with blood rules. It's distant, I know, and August Cato was an old man when he took over little Fawn Blackhorse, and he never would have done it without Blackhorse permission, and he never would have received permission if he had had a loose reputation, because coupling outside marriage or takeovers was not only frowned upon, it could get you ostracized so completely it behooved the fornicators to pack up and leave. As may have been the case, it would explain the line through his name with Ethan Blackhorse, Drum's youngest brother, and a woman named Solis, and certainly was believed to be the case with Martha Stone, Menace's mother, although Harper Jury couldn't settle on whom he thought his wife betrayed him with. So August Cato shunned temptation or any thought of looking outside the families and asked Thomas and Peter Blackhorse for Peter's daughter, Fawn. And maybe his advanced age was why she had just the one child, my husband, Billy. Still, the Blackhorse blood is there, and that makes my daughter, Billy Delia, a fifth cousin to Stone and Dovey, because Peter Blackhorse was brother to Thomas Blackhorse and Sally Blackhorse, and Thomas Blackhorse was Soane's and Dovey's father. Now, Sally Blackhorse married Aaron Poole and had 13 children, one of whom Aaron was going to name Deep, but Sally pitched a fit. So Aaron, with a humor more grim than anybody would have thought, named him Deeper. But two others of those 13 children Billy Delia is in love with, and there is something wrong with that. But other than number and blood rules, I can't figure out what. Pat underscored the last five words, then wrote down her mother's name, drew a line under it, enclosed it in a heart, and continued. The women really tried, Mama. They really did. Kate's mother, Catherine Jury, you remember her, and Fairy Dupre, she's dead now, along with Lone and Dovey Morgan and Charity Flood. But none of them could drive then. You must have believed that deep down they hated you. But not all of them, maybe none of them, because they begged the men to go to the convent to get help. I heard them. Dovey Morgan was crying as she left to find somebody, going from house to house, to Hopper Jury, Catherine's own husband, to Charity's husband, Ace Flood, and to Sergeant Persons. How come that ignorant Negro doesn't know his name is Pearson? All of the excuses were valid, reasonable. Even with their wives begging, they came up with excuses because they looked down on you, Mama. I know it, and despised Daddy for marrying a wife with no last name, a wife without people, a wife of sunlight skin, a wife of racial tampering. Both midwives were in trouble. It was coming too soon. Legs folded underneath, and all they wanted was to get one of the nuns at the convent. Miss Ferry said one of them used to work in a hospital. Catherine Jury went to Soane's to see if Deke was there. He wasn't, but Dovey was. It was Dovey who went to Seawright's, then Fleetwood's, went to every house in walking distance. The Moss Duprés lived way, way out. So did Nathan, who would have hitched hard goods and galloped to Jesus for help. So did Stuart, the Pools, the Sands, and the rest. Finally, they got Senior Pulliam to agree. But by the time he got his shoes tied, it was too late. Miss Ferry rushed from your bedside to Pulliam's house and hollered through the door, too exhausted to knock, too angry to step inside, and said, "You can take your shoes back off, Senior. Might as well get your preacher clothes ready so you'll be in time for the funeral." Then she was gone from there. When Daddy got back, everybody was worried sick about what to do and how long the bodies could last before, father or no father, husband or no husband, you both had to go in the ground. But Daddy came back the second day. No time for a decent wake. So you were his first job, and a wonderful job he did too. You were beautiful. With the baby in the crook of your arm, you would have been so proud of him. He doesn't blame anybody except himself for being at mortuary graduation. We have quarreled about it, and he doesn't agree with me that those 8 rock men didn't want to go and bring a white into town, or else didn't want to drive out to a white's house begging for help, or else they just despised your pale skin so much they thought of reasons why they could not go. Daddy says more than one woman has died in childbirth, and I say who? So the mother without one died, and the baby, whom you plan to name Faustine, if a girl, or Richard, after Daddy's older brother, if a boy, died too. It was a girl, Mama. Faustine, my baby sister. We would have grown up together. Patricia and Faustine. Too light, maybe, but together it would not have mattered to us. We'd be a team. I have no aunts or uncles, remember, because all of Daddy's sisters and brothers died of what they called walking pneumonia. But what must have been the 1919 influenza epidemic? So I married Billy Cato, partly because he was beautiful, partly because he made me laugh, and partly, mostly, because he had the midnight skin of the Catos and the black horses, along with that black horse feature of stick straight hair, like Soane's and Dovey's hair, and like Easter and Scout had. But he died, Billy did, and I took my lightish but not whitish baby and moved back in your pretty little house with the mortuary and your headstone in back, and have been dry so long teaching the children who call me Miss Best, using Daddy's last name as everybody else does. So short was the time I was Pat Cato. The words had long ago covered the back of the page, so she was using fresh sheets to continue. I may as well tell you that except for you and Katie's mother, nobody in Ruby has ever died. Please note, I said in Ruby, and they are real proud about that, believing they are blessed and all, because after 1953, anybody who died did it in Europe or Korea or someplace outside this town. Even Sweetie's children are still alive, and God knows there is no reason they should be. Well, crazy as it sounds, I believe the claim of immortality is this town's rebuke against Daddy's mortuary business, since he has to wait for our killed in actions or somebody out at the convent or an accident someplace else. Otherwise, his ambulance is never a hearse. When Billy died, there was nothing left to bury except some effects, including a gold ring too twisted to poke a finger through. They think Daddy deserves rebuke because he broke the blood rule first, and I wouldn't put it past them to refuse to die just to keep Daddy from success. As it turned out, war dead and accidents in other towns, Miss Fairy died on a trip back to Haven. Ace Flood died in the Denby Hospital, but was buried in Haven, where all the work Daddy has had, and it's hardly enough. Neither is the ambulance business. So I work hard to convince him that the money the town pays me for teaching is just household money, and he doesn't have to borrow any more on his shares in Deke's Bank, and should forget gasoline stations and what all. Leaning back in the chair, Pat folded her hands behind her head, wondering what was going to happen when more people got as old as Nathan or Lone. Then would her father's craft be required, or would they do what they did on the way out of Louisiana, bury them where they fell? Or were they right? Was death blocked from entering Ruby? Patricia was tired now and ready for sleep, but she couldn't let Delia go just yet. That was some ride, Mama, from Haven to here. You and me, Mama, among those skinny blue-black giants, neither they nor their wives staring at your long brown hair, your honey-speckled eyes. Did Daddy tell you, don't worry your head, it was going to be all right? Remember how they needed you, used you to go into a store to get supplies or a can of milk while they parked around the corner? That was the only thing your skin was good for. Otherwise it bothered them, reminded them of why Haven existed, of why a new town had to take its place. The one-drop law the whites made up was hard to live by if nobody could tell it was there. When we drove through a town or when a sheriff's car was near, Daddy told us to get down, to lie on the floor of the car, because it would have been no use telling a stranger that you were colored, and worse, to say you were his wife. Did Soane or Dovey, new brides too, talk woman talk with you? You thought you were pregnant again, and so did they. So did you talk together about how you all felt? Make tea for hemorrhoids, give one another salt to lick, or copper dirt to eat in secret? I craved baking soda when I carried Billy Delia. Did you, when you carried me? Did the older women with children too advise you, like Aaron's wife Sally, with four children already? What about Alice Pulliam? Her husband wasn't a reverend yet, but he had already heard the call and decided to become one. So they must have had some charitable, some godly feelings then, when they were young. Did they make you welcome right away? Or did they all wait for the oven to be reassembled, or the following year, when the stream came back, baptize you, just so they could speak to you directly, look you in the eyes? What did Daddy say to you at that AME Zion picnic, the one held for colored soldiers stationed at the base in Tennessee? How could either of you tell what the other was saying? He talking Louisiana, you speaking Tennessee. The music so different, the sound coming from a different part of the body. It must have been like hearing lyrics set to scores by two different composers. But when you made love, he must have said, I love you. And you understood that. And it was true, too. Because I have seen the desperation in his eyes ever since, no matter what business venture he thinks up. Pat stopped and rubbed the callus on her middle finger. Her elbow and shoulder ached from gripping the pen so hard. Across the hall, through the bedroom door, she could hear her father snoring. As always, she wished him pleasant dreams. Something to assuage the unhappiness of his days, days spent trying to please, to make up for, except for marrying her mother. She couldn't think what rule he had broken that made him so eager for the approval of those who disrespected him. He had described to her once what Haven looked like when he got out of the army. He said he sat on his father's porch, coughing, so nobody would know he was weeping for us. His father, Fulton Best, and his mother, Olive, were inside, reading with great sorrow the applications he had filled out for the GI Bill funding. He wanted a college education so he could go to medical school, but he was also their only surviving child, all the others having died in the flu epidemic. His parents could not bear the thought of either his leaving again or his staying in a town slipping into erasure forever in every place except the heart. He was looking up and down the cracked concrete of Main Street when Ace Flood and Harper Jury walked up to him saying there was a plan. Deke and Steward Morgan had a plan. When he heard what it was, the first thing he did was write to the hazel-eyed girl with light brown hair who'd had his child during the war. Good thing he didn't tell them about us. They would have dissuaded him from marriage the way later on they did Menace. Maybe he knew they would, which is why he just sent for us. Darling Delia, come on, right now. Here is the money order. I'm going to have a lot of trouble keeping my heart quiet. Until you get here, I will be a crazy man. Their jaws must have dropped when we arrived. But other than Stuart, nobody said anything directly. They didn't have to. Olive took to her bed. Fulton kept grunting and rubbing his knees. Only Stuart had the gall to say out loud, "He's bringing along the dung we're leaving behind." Dovey hushed him, Soane too, but Ferry Dupre cursed him, saying, "God don't love ugly ways. Watch out he don't deny you what you love, too." A remark Dovey must have thought about a lot until 1964, when the curse was completed. But they were just women, and what they said was easily ignored by the good, brave men on their way to paradise. They got there, too, and eventually had the satisfaction of seeing the dung buried. Most of it, anyway. Some of it is still above ground, instructing their grandchildren in a level of intelligence their elders will never acquire. Pat sucked her teeth and pushed aside the Best file. She selected a composition notebook and, without label or introduction, continued to write. "She won't listen to me. Not one word. She works in Denby at a clinic, cleaning up, I think, but she makes out like she's a nurse's aide because of the uniform she has to wear. I don't know how she lives. I mean, she has a room, she says, in the house of a nice family. I don't believe it. Not all of it, anyway. One of those pool boys, both of them probably, is visiting her. I know, because the littlest one, Dinah, told the class about her big brother showing her a house with a Santa Claus and Christmas lights all over the porch. Well, that was someplace other than Ruby, for sure. She is lying, and I would rather be bit by the serpent himself than have a lying child. I don't mean to hit her so hard. I didn't know I had. I just meant to stop her lying mouth telling me she didn't do anything. I saw them, all three of them back behind the oven, and she was in the middle. Plus, I am the one who washes sheets around here." Pat stopped, put down her pen, and covering her eyes with her hand, tried to separate what she had seen from what she feared to see? And what did the sheets have to do with it? Was there blood where there should not have been, or no blood where there should have been? It was more than a year ago, and she thought everything was seared in her memory. The fight took place in October of 1973. Afterwards, Billie Delia ran off and stayed at the convent for 2 weeks and one day. She came back during the morning session while Pat was teaching the under-12s and stayed long enough to say she wasn't going to. They'd had ugly, hateful words, but both were afraid to get near the other lest the quarrel get physical as it had before. She left with one of those pool boys and didn't come back till early this year to describe her job and write down her address. Since then, Pat had seen her twice, once in March and then at Arnett's wedding, where she was bridesmaid and maid of honor both, since Arnett would not have anybody else, and no other girl wanted the honor anyway if it meant walking down the aisle with Billie Delia. Or so Pat thought. She had gone to the wedding, not the reception. But she hadn't missed a thing, since she had a perfect view of the goings-on at the oven with those girls from the convent. She saw them. She saw those pool boys. And she saw Billie Delia sit down and talk to one of the girls like they were old friends. She saw Reverend Pulliam and Steward Morgan argue with the girls. And when they drove off, she saw Billie Delia throw her bouquet in Anna's trash can before she strolled off, Apollo and Brood Pool in tow. Billie Delia left the next day in her very own car and never said a word to her about the wedding, the reception, the convent girls, or anything. Pat tried to remember how that pressing iron got into her hand. What had been said that had her running up the stairs with a 1950 GE electric iron called Royal Ease clutched in her fingers to slam against her daughter's head. She, the gentlest of souls, missed killing her own daughter by inches. She who loved children and protected them not only from each other, but from two stern parents, lunged after her own daughter. She, who had trained herself to reasoning and soft manners and discretion and dignity, falling down the stairs and bruising herself so badly she had to cancel 2 days of class. Educated but self-taught, also to make sure that everybody knew that the bastard-born daughter of the woman with sunlight skin and no last name was not only lovely, but of great worth and inestimable value. Trying to understand how she could have picked up that pressing iron, Pat realized that ever since Billie Delia was an infant, she thought of her as a liability somehow, vulnerable to the possibility of not being quite as much of a lady as Patricia Cato would like. Was it that business of pulling down her panties in the street? Billie Delia was only 3 then. Pat knew that had her daughter been an 8-rock, they would not have held it against her. They would have seen it for what it was. Only an innocent child would have done that, surely. Have I missed something? Was there something else? But the question for her now, in the silence of this here night, was whether she had defended Billie Delia or sacrificed her. And was she sacrificing her still? The Royal Ease in her hand, as she ran up the stairs, was there to smash the young girl that lived in the minds of the 8-rocks, not the girl her daughter was. Pat licked her bottom lip, tasted salt, and wondered who exactly the tears were for. Nathan Dupre, believed to be the oldest male in Ruby, welcomed the audience. He disputed the claim of seniority every year, pointing to his cousin Moss, then saying Reverend Simon Carey was a more suitable choice. But he let the town persuade him in the end, because Reverend Carey talked too long. Besides which, he was not among the first families, so his arrival was associated not with World War II, but with Korea. A stalwart man of such loving kindness, even Steward Morgan admired him. Nathan had married Elder Morgan's daughter, Mirth. Because they had no surviving children, he deeply cherished other people's, hosting the annual Children's Day picnic, fine-tuning the rehearsals, keeping cough drops and fireballs in his pockets to pass out. Now, smelling slightly of the horse he'd just dismounted, he climbed the platform and surveyed the audience. Nathan cleared his throat and surprised himself. Whatever he'd prepared to say had left him, and the words he did say seemed appropriate to some other event. "I was 5," he said, "when we left Louisiana, and 65 when I hopped in the truck, leaving Haven behind for this here new place. I know I wouldn't have done it if Mirth was alive or any of our children was still above ground. You all know my babies, all of them, was took by a tornado in 1922. Me and Mirth found them in a stranger's wheat field. But I never regretted coming here, never. There is honey in this land, sweeter than any I know of, and I have cut cane in places where the dirt itself tasted like sugar, so that's saying a heap. No, I never had a gnat's minute worth of regret, but there's a sadness in me now. Maybe in this season of my Lord's birth, I'll learn what it is. This parch in my throat, the water that stays in my eyes. I know I've seen more years than God usually allows a man, but this dryness is new. The eye water, too. When I run my mind over it, all I can come up with is a dream I had a while back." In the next to last row, Lone Dupre sat next to Richard Meisner, Anna on his other side. She leaned forward to glance at Anna and learn whether she, too, was losing her mind. Anna smiled but did not return her look. So she sat back to endure another one of old Nathan's incoherent dreams. Nathan ran his fingers over his head, closed his eyes as if to get the details straight. "It was an Indian come up to me in a bean row. Cheyenne, I believe. The vines were green, tender, the blossoms coming out all over. He looked at the row and shook his head, sorrowful-like. Then he told me too bad the water was bad, and said there was plenty of it, but it was foul. I said, but look here. Look at all the flowers. Looks like a top crop to me. He said, the tallest cotton don't yield the best crop. Besides, those flowers the wrong color. They's red. And I looked, and sure enough, they was turning pink, then red, like blood drops. Scared me some. But when I looked back, he was gone, and the petals was white again. I reckon that sighting is like this here story we going to tell again this evening. It shows the strength of our crop, if we understand it. But it can break us if we don't, and bloody us too. May God bless the pure and holy, and may nothing keep us apart from each other, nor from the one who does the blessing. Amen. When Nathan left the platform, amidst murmurs of kindness, if not gratitude, Richard Meisner took advantage of the pause to whisper something to Anna and leave his seat. He was hoping to relieve nascent waves of the claustrophobia that had not plagued him since he was jailed with 38 others in a tiny cell in Alabama. He had embarrassed himself then, because the sweat and nausea signaled fear to his companions. And it was a hard lesson, knowing that whatever risks he took, however eager he was for the dangerous confrontation, a crowded cell could humiliate him before teenagers without pity. Now, feeling the onslaught of suffocation in this tightly packed schoolhouse, he joined Pat Best, standing in the hall, watching the play and the audience through the door. A long table of cakes, cookies, and punch lined the wall behind her. "Hello, Reverend." Pat did not look at him, but adjusted her body to accommodate him in the doorway. "Evening, Pat," he said, blotting moisture from his neck with his handkerchief. "Out here is better for me." "Me too. See everything from here without stretching or peeping between two hats." They looked over the heads of the audience as the curtains, made of percale sheets, laundered and carefully ironed, wavered. Children in white surplices filed through the parting. The perfection of their serious faces and flawless hair, undone occasionally by a knee sock sliding down to an ankle, or a bow tie twisted to the right. After a glance at Kate Golightly, they took a uniform breath for, "Oh, holy night, the stars are brightly shining." At the second verse, Richard Meisner leaned over to Pat. "Mind if I ask you something?" "No, go ahead." She thought he was going to ask for a donation because he had been having difficulty raising money in the quantities he hoped for to aid the legal defense of four teenagers arrested in Norman and charged with possession, resisting, arson, disorderly, inciting, and whatever else the prosecution could ferret out of its statutes to level against black boys who said no or thought about it. They had been in jail, Richard Meisner told his congregation, for almost 2 years. When arraigned, they had been behind bars for 20 months. The trial date was about to be set, and lawyers needed to be paid for services already rendered and more to come. So far, Richard had collected only what the women had given, women who thought more about the pain felt by the boys' mothers than of the injustice of their son's situation. The men, however, Fleetwoods, Pulliam, Sergeant Person, and the Morgans, had been adamant in their refusal. Clearly, Richard had not carefully enough shaped his plea. He should have built a prodigal son's foundation rather than a political one. Then, as he stood outside Calvary, continuing his request, he would not have had to listen to "I Don't Hold with Violence" from men who had handled guns all their lives, or "Little illegal niggers with guns and no home training need to be in jail." This from Stewart, of course. However much Richard insisted they had no guns, that demonstrations were not illegal, the men kept their wallets closed. Pat decided, if asked directly, to donate as much as she could. It was pleasant to think of his needing her generosity. So she was annoyed to learn that that was not at all what was on Richard Meisner's mind. "I'm trying to smooth the situation out at the pools, and I think I'd do well to talk to Billy Delia, if you don't mind. Is she here tonight?" Pat held onto her elbows and turned to look at him. "Can't help you, Reverend." "You sure?" "I'm sure that whatever's going on out there has nothing to do with Billy Delia. Besides, she doesn't live here anymore. Moved to Denby." She would have liked to stop being so hostile to him, but with the mention of her daughter's relationship with those pool boys, she couldn't control it. "Her name's come up once or twice, but Wisdom Pool won't give me anything to go on. Something's tearing that family apart. They don't like prying, Reverend. It's a thing about Ruby. I understand that, but something like this has a way of spreading, touching more than one family. When I first came here, it was plain. If there was a problem brewing, a delegation was formed to see about it. Keep people from falling out with one another. Seen it with my own eyes and been a party to it, too. I know. This community used to be tight as wax. It still is in a crisis, but they keep to themselves otherwise. Don't you mean we keep to ourselves? If I did, would you be asking me to explain things? Pat, please, don't take anything I say amiss. I just remembered that the young people in Bible class say they too when talking about their parents. Bible class, more like a war class, kind of military from what I hear. Militant, maybe, not military. No budding panthers. Is that what you think? I don't know what to think. Well, let me tell you. Unlike most of the folks here, we read newspapers and different kinds of books. We keep up. And yes, we discuss strategies of defense, not aggression, defense. They know the difference. He didn't have to reply right away because applause began and lasted until the final member of the children's choir disappeared behind the curtain. Someone turns off the ceiling lights. Quiet coughing domesticates the dark. Slowly, on a well-oiled pulley, the curtains part. Under lights, positioned in the wings, throwing large shadows behind them, four figures in felt hats and two big suits stand at a table, counting giant dollar bills. The face of each one is hidden by a yellow and white mask featuring gleaming eyes and snarling lips, red as a fresh wound. Above a sign tacked to the table front, which reads, "In," they count money, make slurping noises, and do not stop when a parade of holy families dressed in torn clothes and moving in a slow two-step approaches them. Seven couples line up before the table of money. The boys carry the staffs. The girls cuddle baby dolls. Meisner looks at them and, giving himself more time to think of a reply to Pat's question, concentrated on identifying the children on stage. The four youngest Carrie girls, Hope, Chaste, Lovely, and Pure. Dinah Poole, and one of the pious Dupre's daughters, Linda, then the boys, manfully grasping staffs while they two-stepped toward the money counters. Peace and Solarine Drury's two grandsons, Ansel and the one they called Fruit. Joe Thomas Poole paired with his sister Dinah. Drew and Harriet Person's son, James. Payne Sands' boy, Lorcas, and two of Timothy Seawright's grandsons, Stephen and Michael. Two of the masked ones were obviously Beauchamps, Royal, and Destry, 15 and 16-year-olds who were already over 6 feet tall, but he wasn't sure of the other two. This was the first time he had attended the play. It was held 2 weeks before Christmas when he returned to Georgia for his annual visit to his family. This year, the trip was postponed because an all-family reunion was scheduled for New Year's. He would take Anna if she agreed, let the folks look her over, and, he supposed, let her look them over. He had hinted to the bishops that he was up for a new parish. Nothing urgent, but he was not sure he was well used in Ruby. He had thought any place was fine, as long as there were young people to be taught, to be told that Christ was judge and warrior too, that whites not only had no patent on Christianity. They were often its obstacle. That Jesus had been freed from white religion, and he wanted these kids to know that they did not have to beg for respect. It was already in them, and they needed only to display it. But the resistance he'd found in Ruby was wearing him out. More and more, his students were being chastised about the beliefs he helped instill. Now Pat Best, with whom he'd taught Negro history every Thursday afternoon, was chipping away at his Bible class, confusing self-respect for arrogance, preparedness for disobedience. Did she think education was knowing just enough to get a job? She didn't seem to trust these Ruby hardheads with the future any more than he did, but neither did she encourage change. Negro history and lists of old-time achievements were enough for her, but not for this generation. Somebody had to talk to them, and somebody had to listen to them. Otherwise, you know better than anybody how smart these young people are, better than anybody. His voice trailed off under silent night. You think what I teach them isn't good enough?